When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham. Once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, someone I've been hoping to talk to for a very long time. He has a fantastic new record, which is, I'm going to try and get this name right because it's is an unruly name. A Coctopus's Garden, now that's what I call capitalism, the musical. Danbert No Bacon is on the show, formerly of Chumbawamba. This is a good one. Get ready. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham. You get the message to me. Huge thank you to our buddy, John Gentle from punknews.org. for helping us set up this interview, as always, and check out all the stuff John does. John's a great friend of the show, so appreciate that, John. You can also find me on Twitter or Instagram at Left4Damian. There is a YouTube page, a TikTok page, an Instagram page, and a Facebook page, all run for this podcast at Turned Out of Punk on those platforms where you find that stuff. Check out the YouTube page for video versions of this podcast. I spend hours editing these things. It takes forever. And you can check them out now and enjoy the labors of my labors over there. I also play in a band. If you want to support the show, tell all your friends about it. But you can also check out the band I play in. You can find out more information over at fuckedup.cc. We have a brand new record called Another Day. And we have done a very special Turned Out of Punk edition of that on green vinyl that is available from our friends over at Emissions Records. There's around 150 of them, I think, and they are going quickly, but I will have a link in the description to hit up Emissions if you want to order one, especially if you're in Canada. It's cheaper postage because it ships from Canada. So if you've been kind of like, I don't want to get one of these weird versions of this fucked up record because of postage, we got you covered. And I hope you enjoy the record. I'm really proud of it. We spent some time doing it one day drawn out over a long period of time, but oh my gosh, it was, yeah. Anyway, this isn't about fucked up. This is about Danbert No Bacon, because today on the show, Danbert is here. As I said off the top, he's the one I've wanted to talk to for a very long time. And I really do love his brand new solo record. I guess he's got a band for it too. It's Danbert No Bacon and the Axis of Descent. This is a really cool, I think it's a double album actually on vinyl, a record that's conceptually kind of deals with a lot of different stuff, and it takes place. It's a stage recording for a stage musical that hasn't happened yet. You can read about it, but the songs are all great, fantastic. He's an amazing songwriter, as you are well aware. And yes, someone, as I said, I've wanted to talk to you for a very long time, because Chumbawamba, which the band that he used to play in until 2004, is a band that came out of the anarcho, if that's how you want to pronounce it, punk scene in the UK. And built up this huge following, put out tons of incredible records, and then at a certain point, signed to a major label and put out a song that wasn't just a song. It winds up being one of the biggest songs, certainly of that year, but maybe of that era. And from there, the story gets interesting and really weird. The story's interesting the whole way along. Like, Chumbawamba is a band that I love as a fan of the music, but also just like looking at the history of this band and all the intersections they have with different places. And well, you're going to hear about those in a second. I don't think I've got any notes off the top to get to for this one. So I'm just going to let you listen to it. So kick back, relax, or actually get hyped, sit up. No. Yeah, kick back, relax, and enjoy Dan Burton No Bacon on Turned Out a Punk. Dan Burton, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Cool. Thanks. Thanks for having me, Damien.
Well, as I was just telling you off air, you are someone I've wanted to talk to for a very long time. I'm a longtime fan of the band, but our Chumbawamba, your solo stuff as well, everything. But I'm just, there's just so much to ask you, but I got to start off the way they all start off, which is, Dambert, how'd you get into punk? Remember the first time you ever came across it?
So I think I was, I see it as being very lucky. Me and some of the original Chumbawamba guys, we were just the right age when punk rock started coming to the smaller northern towns in England in the late 70s. 16 going on 17 years old. And it was like this, just a breath of fresh air, really. It just seemed so different. You know, prior to that, we were listening to, you know, what we call pomp rock or prog rock in England, bands like Yes or Genesis. And I had no musical education, and I just believe you had to be a genius to be in a band, classically trained or something. I don't know where I got that from, but punk rock came along and it's, okay, no, you can just learn three chords and make up some words. And it literally changed my life, and I've been doing it ever since.
Well, it's interesting. I think Jaw Wobble, when he was on the show the other day, was saying that, like, there's a real shift back to this sort of idea that anyone can do a band that happens with punk rock, because like you're saying, it had become so fantastical with prog and even glam, where you needed money for costumes, makeup, like,
yeah,
it had just become out of reach for kids.
Yeah. And it just came like a hurricane almost, it seemed like. And I think we were just in the right place at the right time, because it wasn't just us. There were, you know, other people, local bands starting up. And then, you know, we just wanted to go see bands. And then we're like, well, maybe we should start a band. And that's where it began.
What was the first sort of punk show you remember going to?
The first proper one was The Adverts.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
The British band. And so I lived in this town, Burnley, which is north of Manchester. Manchester's like 24 miles away, and Blackburn was like 12 miles away. And the bigger bands would come. Some would come to Blackburn, and some had, most of them had come to Manchester. And we could get a bus. And there was a late bus, but often the band would be like playing their encore, and it's like, oh, it's time to run for the bus. And sometimes we'd miss it. You know, but it was an amazing time, really.
Who were the first bands you remember that kind of, because, you know, there is a moment in punk that happens, and it happens really early on, especially with the UK punk, where there's a shift between this being this thing that's there to shock and awe people into being this thing that's actually meant to be kind of productive, like the Desperate Bicycles, Medium is Tedium, yeah, and like that kind of era of stuff, where it's about DIY, it's about scene building. When's your first sort of experience coming into that world?
So, like I said, well, it was kind of, there was like a local arts association, and we'd formed this band. They were called Chimp Eats Banana. And there was a local band called Not Sensibles and a couple of others. And this arts association said, oh, we're thinking of getting a music collective together. You know, they were just to us like adults who had resources or whatever. And so we went to the meeting and we'd never played a gig or anything, but one of us put our name on the list, you know, you'd signed up. And then like 4 weeks later, the guy rings up and he's go, okay, you've got a gig and it's on Halloween and it's at the arts thing outside with a bonfire. And suddenly we're like, oh my goodness. So we played this gig and that for me was probably the most transformative thing, because I'd never been on stage. And at that time I was there were like four of us and we had like four songs and I was the singer. And you know, all I remember is being terrified and then getting on stage and there's just a bright light in my face and I could sort of see people, but whatever it was, the adrenaline was just revolutionary. I thought, yeah, I want to do this.
It's intoxicating. Like, it's something you can never get.
Yeah. So to go back to your question, that on a local level, that's kind of what transformed, you know, cause there was a handful of bands or more. And that kind of scene lasted for probably 18 months, you know, where we were playing local shows and putting out like a cassette album, very DIY, you know, and on a more national scale. I mean, Britain's very small, but London seemed like a long way away. And a lot of the bands, they're all based in London, even if they're not from there. The impetus is, oh, you got to move to London, but we were never interested in that. So, you know, like the Clash had come play in Blackburn or whatever, or Manchester or some of those bigger bands. And, you know, we'd go see them obviously, but there was like an emerging, more underground band, especially in Manchester, you know, and at that time bands like, I wouldn't say they were, part of a scene, like The Fall, for instance, was playing shows and we'd go see them. And
Panic, you know, I guess Panic, the pre Joy Division band. It's like one of the, it had some like connection to Joy Division, at least I think.
I'm not sure. Yeah, there was one called Warsaw, pre Joy Division band, but when we saw them, they were Joy Division. But it seemed like, you know, and we were a little bit behind the Manchester scene. But there was a lot of Manchester bands coming out of punk rock, you know, Buzzcocks, obviously, who also we'd go see. And just a lot of bands who maybe made one EP or one album and then kind of, you know, that was their lifespan.
Yeah, there's just so much stuff that comes out during that period. Like, there's just so many incredible singles. Like, that Not Sensible single is fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And
we go tour around with them and they joined like a Manchester collective. And so we'd go, you know, somebody had organized like a bus to take people from Burnley to Manchester to go see Not Sensibles. And then we could all get home after. It was there was a lot of, you know, and all the local bands in our scene, we all put out EPs and stuff, you know, and that was another thing, the idea that you could make a record or go in a studio, you know, because prior to punk rock, that was just like another universe almost, you know, and we kind of stumbled into it with punk rock. And I guess, you know, the studios and people who press records were like, yeah, there's a lot of business. So it's cool that they were kind of into it as well.
Yeah, it's interesting how it's the moment where the means of production is in the hands of the musicians for the first time, in a way that you can.
Yeah.
Like all that stuff, say, like the photocopier, the tape deck, like all these things allowed for anyone to do this. Like, you just needed the basis level to kind of afford this technology to kind of get in there.
Yeah, there was, I mean, I don't know what it was like before. If we'd been there like 3 years before trying to be a glam rock band, I don't know how easy that would have been, but it just seemed, oh yeah, you literally do it yourself, you know, and it was just a great way to, just have the best fun, but also realize that, oh yeah, this is, you know, people come and see this and are inspired by it, you know, and I guess realizing that, oh yeah, I am something in me that needs to be expressed as an artist, you know, realizing that, oh, I'm an artist. Because, you know, I think prior to punk rock, I don't know what I thought I would end up doing as an adult, but it was nothing related to the arts at all.
Yeah, like it really, well, it is an entry point for so many people that would wind up doing not just stuff in music, right? Like film, fashion, like there's just food. There's so many interesting people that found a way to kind of like break out, and it attracts interesting people. Like that's the thing that seems to kind of keep it alive and keep it vibrant, is that it's always going to be this thing that brings people that think differently to it and allows them to kind of express themselves.
Yeah.
I could imagine it created a generation gap, though, with the older bands, like the bands that had been there 3 years before, because all of a sudden, all the things that they had done, all the work shedding, all this sort of stuff just was no longer the currency. It was like a new thing with a new technology and a younger wave.
Yeah, I think we would definitely, you know, I mean, if you studied it in total detail, you could probably detect a series of waves. And I mean, what changed for us, you know, we had this band for 18 months and then it was time to go off to college. So we went off to college, you know, and quickly realized that, or, you know, we're still just going to see shows, and quickly realized, oh, we still want to be in a band. Three of us, the original members of Chumbawamba. And so we, the three of us ended up going to the same school, Leeds, which is a bigger city to the east. And there was a scene there, bands like Mekons and Gang of Four, came out of Leeds colleges. So to us, they were like, probably a second wave, you know, after Sex Pistols and Clash, and they were, you know, people we kind of looked up to and could easily go see because they played a lot locally. You know, and we had, you know, the John Peel radio show on the BBC every, you know, five nights a week at that time. And he was the only DJ playing punk music. He played a lot of other things as well. And they did radio sessions where bands would record, go to the BBC studios and record four songs in a day with the BBC engineers. And these did have these, you know, live, recorded sessions. They were called John Peel sessions. And a lot of them are available now. You can go find them. And some amazing stuff came out. You know, and Mekons and Gang of Four did it. And we eventually, Chumbawamba eventually ended up doing John Peel sessions. So it just seemed that, you know, at that time, the late 70s and early 80s, that it was like an all-engrossing, you know, we didn't last very long in school, dropped out, and that's when Chumbawamba started in Leeds, you know, a bigger city. More opportunity to play music at that time.
Was the scene still kind of centered around the Fenton at that point, or had it kind of moved on from that era?
There was stuff there, but there were other places. And it's funny, there was this thing called the Dole Q Club, which the Dole, you know, unemployment and early 80s recession. And so we basically dropped out of school and were on unemployment. And at that time, you could get away with kind of being, you know, because there was a lack of jobs. And it was before Margaret Thatcher really started attacking everything, the early days of it. So we could exist and we lived cheap, and we ended up living in a squat, so we didn't pay rent. And that was like the band house. And we could get by on unemployment. And the Dole Q Club was like, you know, the culture of mass unemployment in Britain at the time. And it's same thing. It was like local bands, and we signed up and we ended up playing. And then there was a venue in Bradford, which is 12 miles from Leeds, called the 1 in 12 Club. And they're still going. And we played some of their early shows before they had a building, and then they managed to get a building. And, you know, we helped, along with a lot of other people, fix the building up.
Yeah, 1 in 12 doesn't really get the credit that Gilman does, but in terms of all ages spaces, that's such an institution. Like, what an important place.
Have you guys played there?
Yeah, a few times. We actually we did an Enemy cover shoot there. And kids built a Trojan horse out of boxes to mock the fact that we were Trojan horsening the enemy into the 1 in 12 club.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
It's awesome. There's also that Indian restaurant around the corner, or Indian food restaurant around the corner, that has the naan bread that's the size of the table. Did you ever go there?
Yeah. I'm not sure if I know the particular one, but there is a kind of trend, you know, Indian restaurants in Northern England to have enormous naan.
It's incredible, but not a good thing to eat before you play a sweaty set. And I've made that mistake a couple times over the years. When John King was on the podcast, he talked about a night when the Nazi skinheads attacked the Fenton, and they had to fight all the punks in the Fenton were fighting off the Nazis. And it is the birthplace of Nazi punk, right? The Dentists, I guess, were a band from there. And it's kind of like where that sort of insurgency into punk begins. Was that a present threat a few years later when you guys were there?
You know, it's funny, Leeds did have that reputation, and particularly because of the soccer team. The soccer team had a kind of Nazi following at that time. And there was like a group, this is probably a few years later, but we never had it in Leeds. We had it in other places. But there was like a group of soccer fans who were like, no, we don't want our team to be associated with Nazism. And I can't remember the exact name of the group, but they were quite successful in. And I do remember being outside the football ground one time, and there were some Nazis there trying to sell their magazine or whatever. And then the other group came along, and basically the Nazis were outnumbered by a huge amount and basically ended up, you know, running away or moving on. I don't think it was like a fight, but it was a confrontation. But that's probably mid-80s or later, I would say.
Because the Skin Disease track comes out around the same time as the first tape, right? Or the split tape.
Yeah. So there was, you know, a general atmosphere in Britain that, yeah, Nazis and Nazi punk is a thing, you know. And, you know, the Skin Disease thing, you know, Gary Bushrell at Sounds was kind of encouraging that, you know, kind of like Trump encourages the worst in, you know, American populists, I guess. So it was a thing. And, you know, we, by 1982, when Chumbawamba started playing shows, the very quickly the anarcho punk scene kind of sprang up. You know, we'd seen Crass play, and Crass did this squat gig in London, and we went, and then it was like, oh yeah, take over a building for a day and have a concert with loads of bands. And we did one in Leeds, and we played them in other towns. And you know, we our ever first recording is on the Crass Bullshit Detector compilation album. So we wrote to the other bands on there and said, oh, we're doing a, you know, we'd all just become vegetarians. We're doing a themed cassette album, and it was called The Animals Packet, and it had information in it as well. And so we kind of got in contact with those bands and became part of that emerging anarcho-punk scene. And we did tours with Flux of Pink Indians and Björk's first band, the Icelandic band Kukul, KUKL. And we were doing, I think this is 1984, we were doing a benefit tour for the miners' strike. And we played a show in Birmingham, and these skinheads basically came in, probably like 10 or 15 of them. And you know, there's a venue and there's like 100 people or more there. But because of the like the pacifist element of anarcho-punk, these skinheads basically put like three or four people in hospital, including the drummer of Flux of Pink Indians, and basically trashed the gig. And after that, we said, you know, Chumbawamba, never again. We're not going to let that happen again. And we had a couple of occasions in Britain where, you know, somebody's in the crowd, like just being obnoxious, or, and, you know, we'd literally get off stage if we needed to throw them out. And we didn't really attract that mentality as much as some of the other bands, I don't think, because probably because of the music, you know, our music, we, you know, we had two women in the band at that time, and we were kind of mellower, I guess, in a way. I'm not, we weren't like full on pop by then, but we often, and it was more if we were playing with other bands who were more punk rock, who did attract that, you know, because some of the Nazi guys, they just didn't get, they liked the music, but they didn't get what the message was, it seemed.
So I always wondered, was it that or an act of direct agitation, them showing up at these shows? Because you hear stuff about them showing up at like Poison Girl shows early on, where it seems like that is almost like direct provocation. They're just trying to do that.
I think so. I think there was that, you know, in the early 80s, you know, and certainly that gig with Flux of Pink Indians, it seemed like it was a total deliberate, organized move to disrupt the show or whatever. But you know, the times after that, I think it was just more random. We had one show in, I want to say, Memphis in the US. This is 10 years later, where this guy apparently is infamous, and he had this out, you know, he was handing out leaflets, and it was called Vegan Reich.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that.
And yeah, and same thing, he was just like causing trouble. Once we started playing, he was just like in the mosh pit or whatever, basically, you know, punching people, it seemed. So we just got off stage and threw him out. And the crowd just applauded. They were like, oh my God, because nobody had stood up to him, you know, and he'd been terrorizing locals, I guess. I don't know how these people operate, but I would say, you know, Chumbawamba, you know, we played a lot of like anti-fascist shows and in Europe. I mean, we had one in Prague one time where I think the opening band had been on, and then suddenly the people who were running the show, it was in like a like a classic kind of music hall kind of venue, and the people said, "Okay, we've had a phone call saying there's a bomb in the building, some fascist." And that definitely was targeted, at us, and we had to evacuate the building for an hour, and everyone's on the street, and then they search the building, and obviously there's nothing there, so we go back, and the show did go on, but it kind of got delayed, and then in Leeds, in the mid-90s, we made a live album, Show Business, and so we did two nights at the local venue, and recorded. And there was some fascists targeted that, but they were just a handful of people, and there was way more than enough people who were way more organized to prevent them disrupting it,
It's interesting how much of the initial sort of conflict between the anarcho scene and the Oi scene was sort of stoked by, I guess, Sounds Magazine. Dick Lucas said specifically named Sounds Magazine as being one of the places, but and that really is one of the first big walls that goes up in punk and like to subgenre everything off.
So, Gary Bushell in particular, who worked at Sounds and who did the Oi compilations, he basically, he invented genres of music. And then bands that were around, there was one called Splodgenesser Bounds, and I can't remember what the genre was he kind of tried to label those guys with, but it was like kind of crazy, not circus punk, but it was a similar thing to the Oi in that he used his platform, and his ego, I guess, and also we did the Oi compilation, and the contract basically gave him a chunk of the royalties, so it was a money making thing as well from his
It
perspective.
normally is with those kind of moves. So with the Skin Disease track, like obviously very tongue in cheek, and I think that's the first sign that Oi is subversion proof because it will subsume any subversion and just make it an anthem. Because that is, I'm thick becoming an anthem is perfect irony.
And it's funny, we went to London to record it, and the God, what was it called? The guys who would kind of engineer it were, oh my goodness, they were a famous Oi band.
Cockney
The
Rejects.
Stinky Gegger, Cockney, were it Cockney Rejects? Yeah, I think it were Cockney
Okay, that
Rejects.
makes sense.
Yeah, and they were one of those bands who, and we'd sit and play, and a lot of local people kind of were. I never liked them particularly, and they had that thing where they'd have a fascist element, following them. And Sham 69, I think, were the original London kind of band who had terrible trouble with like fascist audience,
Yeah. Well, it eventually kills that scene. And I've like the guys from Coxbar have come on and talked about how it just becomes like completely untenable after a certain point because your audience is overrun with these people and the violence they kind of bring. It's like you're saying, like you almost have to confront it because if you don't confront it, it's just going to spread.
I think, well, as I said, our style didn't attract, the music wasn't hard enough for those guys. So we didn't, unless they targeted us, they didn't like just show up, and be part of our
They
audience.
show up mosh for work and then they're just confused for the rest of the set. Because it feels like right from the first tape, the sound is already kind of there. Like it's kind of this, obviously there's the really straight up punk songs on that first tape too, but there's like you guys are already not going to fit in with a classic, you know, three chord version of this sound. Like it's definitely like a much more interesting take on things than a lot of bands are doing around them. But how did that go over with an audience that is outside of the skinheads? I mean, like just an audience that's conditioned to expect a certain sound.
I think it made us stand out a little bit because a lot of those early shows, the anarcho-punk, you know, there'd be like five or six bands on the bill. And because we had quieter songs or in amongst, you know, what we were trying to be hard punk as well at the same time, I think, but we just maybe weren't as good at it.
No, that song work is fucking sick. Don't sell yourself short. There are some amazing songs in the hard punk genre too on that tape.
Okay. So I just think, you know, because Chimpy's Banana and the very early Chumbawamba predates the anarcho punk scene. So we were more, like I said, The Fall and ATV, we were more like, okay, we want to challenge things musically, you know. We don't want to sound like everybody else. So there was always an element of that about Chumbawamba. And then we were like, oh, well, we don't want to sound like the last record or the last tape when we're making a new tape. That was always a thing, especially with the Chumbawamba albums. We always tried to evolve the music in some direction. So I think you're right. That was kind of there from the very early beginning.
When was the first time you guys made it to Europe? Like, I mean, outside of the UK at that time.
So yeah, we Chumbawamba had our first EP. We call it the Revolution EP, but you know, and it was like a, you know, it was still in that time where you could make a 7-inch and sell a few thousand copies, you know, if you had a bit of a following or whatever. And like I mentioned, John Peel, he picked up on it, and he had this thing at the end of every year, you know, at Christmas, called the Festive 50. And basically his audience called in and voted, you know, on the songs. The Revolution EP was number 6 in the Festive 50, which was a huge deal to us because we'd always looked up to that kind of, you know, that, you know, scene or whatever. And, you know, to be on late night BBC radio and have like number 6 in this, you know, it was kind of obscure compared to the mainstream, but it was like, yeah. And as a result of that, the Dutch band, The X, who could also get the BBC, heard, you know, our song or whatever. And we got a, you know, in those days, letters. They wrote us a letter saying, do you want to play some shows in Holland? And we're like, yeah. And I think that was 1986. And that was the start of us going to Europe. And we were just blown away. I mean, they were so similar to us in attitude. You know, they lived in a squat in outside Amsterdam, and they just seemed so much more organized than us, the European, the Dutch and the Germans. And it just opened our world up completely because there was so many, this whole European scene that which we didn't know about really before. And we got to play in other countries.
The relationship between Chumbawamba and X, I think, once again, just judging from the outside, is such a fascinating one and such an interesting one. Like the tours you guys did, the Antidote 7-inch is phenomenal. Oh, I'm sorry. Can I be unbelievably rude? My child is calling.
Okay. Oh, yeah. No.
Yeah, like the relationship between your two bands, like especially that Antidote 7-inch and the touring you guys did. And once again, just judging from the outside, it's such a cool connection you guys make with each other.
Yeah. And, you know, it's still... So in the early mid-80s, you know, we did a few tours with the X, you know, getting further and further afield, you know, one time in Italy and Switzerland, and then I'm not sure what changed, but we kind of went in different direction, and I think we'd also established, you know, that we could go play in Europe. We didn't necessarily need the X to organize it. We'd started getting a following over there. But we always, you know, our paths always interwove, you know, over the years. And it was particularly fascinating when, when we had the Jumbo Mad, the big song, because bands like the X and Fugazi, who we'd played with a few times, they were just really fascinated with our journey, you know, and they both, the X and Fugazi were like, well, you know, we could never do that, you know, our just the way we do things, you know. But they were really interested in our choices. I mean, maybe this comes up later in the interview.
Oh, believe me, I could. Well, you can talk about it now because I want to talk about it later on as well, I'm sure. But yeah, I definitely think, and obviously I play in a band, and we made not quite as big a jump, and we definitely did not have the songwriting chops to get that hit, but we definitely made a jump, and it's interesting. And it happens a lot. Like, I think anytime you make any sort of jump as a band to a different label, or it's met with an interesting reaction from the people around you, your peers. Like, there's a.
Yeah. Yeah. So they were our peers, you know, they were very different musically, both bands, tours, but we had a kindred spirit, you know, and they weren't necessarily you know, there's some misrepresentation that, oh, Fugazi, you know, were hated Chumbawamba after that, or the ex hated Chumbawamba, which wasn't true at all. They were just genuinely, as friends and peers and artists, just genuinely interested in a different route, you know.
Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And now it all seems so quaint because now we're all on Spotify. We're all like, but at the time there were stakes, right? Like, I always bring up Jello Biafra got assaulted at the Gilman, right? Over a perceived thing about selling out or something crazy, right? Like, there, and there was real, well, I just from judging from the outside, there was real animosity towards you guys from some sectors of punk at that time.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. We alienated certain parts of our following, I guess.
And it's something that every band that's lucky enough to get to that stage is going to be faced with, where,
yeah,
it's like, do you continue on and just do what you do and hope that the audience doesn't burn itself out on it, or you don't burn out as people, or do you make that jump and try and do something, or do you gamble?
Yeah.
I think that's probably why those bands were so fascinating and really wanted to talk to you guys about it, because as Chase, as Fugazi is, I'm sure there's a voice in the back of Ian's mind sometime that's like, yeah, but what if you had gone to Sony in like 95?
Yeah.
Like what could have happened? Like there's always going to be a what if you don't do it. And
yeah.
Anyway, so I'm just fascinated, like, what that process was like internally when you guys were kind of discussing it. And
yeah, it was, you know, we, like I said, we made a cassette album, we made it 7-inch, then we made the first album, and just gradually built up, you know, through the 80s and the early 90s. And by, you know, in the early 90s, we were signed to One Little Indian, a bigger independent label in Britain. And we were on the third album of a 3-album deal, which became Tup Thumper, the album. And they were having real financial problems, which we didn't really know about. So we have a studio booked and for Monday morning, and then Friday prior, we get a phone call at the end of the day, oh, the studio has been cancelled and whatever. And we're halfway through doing the album. And basically, it became so stressed, the situation, that, look, you know, and we had a good management who, you know, our contract allowed us to walk because they weren't fulfilling their end of it. And we want to finish this record. And shortly after that, they sacked half the workers and half the bands. And I think it was because they hadn't paid Björk the royalties for X number of years. And she's still with them, so they must have worked it out. Yeah. So we basically, you know, finished their album on our own dime kind of thing. And we're circulating this album. And, you know, our managers who manage bands like, you know, Motorhead and Hawkwind, so they had good connections. And there was all this hype about the one song. And suddenly we were getting major labels chasing us, which was just unheard of. How can this, you know, we just didn't understand it. But they were labels from America and Europe, not Britain, because we had such a reputation in Britain that, you know, people knew of the politics, you know. So like EMI London didn't want anything to do with us, and it was EMI Germany who signed us for Europe. And it was funny because London had to take orders from Germany, which they never liked doing, but that's an aside. So it was okay, you know, initially, you know, we'd have band meetings about things and like, well, we don't want to sign with a major, you know. And then gradually, as we thought about it and kind of revise, which is how we worked on a lot of things, we'd be opposed to an idea, and then somebody would be devil's advocate or whatever and said, well, what if we did, and maybe we could do this if we did sign. And in the end, after probably a couple of months of like tossing the idea around, we said, we kind of agreed, okay, well, we'll try signing to a major. It'll probably last a year because we'll burn our bridges pretty quickly and we'll have a lot of fun doing it. You know, and we'd been a band for like 15 years at that point. So we'd been around the block. And that's what we did. And it lasted longer than a year. And, you know, I mean, the size of that the reach of that one song was just beyond anybody's imagination, you know.
Yeah, it's like a song that, I don't know, it's just like part of pop culture. Like, it's like the song they'll play at sporting events forever. Like, it's just, yeah. It's just kind of... Yeah, like it's not even a song. It's one of those things that becomes a cultural moment.
Yeah. And in a sense, we, you know, from, you know, Probably from when we were at One Little Indian, so from the early 90s, you know, from being in the punk, kind of angry punk, you know, of the 1980s. You know, we did the a cappella album, which was purely vocal, old English folk songs, trying to find a tradition, which did exist, a tradition, you know, because Scotland and Ireland, you know, had these really strong traditions of rebel music because they'd been colonized by England. But there was also like a working class kind of history of rebel music in England itself. And that's why it was called English Rebel Songs. And in some ways, it, you know, it's like a comparison to like the punk attitude. You know, there's people who are upset with their living conditions because of the oppressors above, kind of thing. So we'd already started like shifting tack, but we like I said, with the band meeting process, we decided, and it was with the Slap album in 1990. Well, we don't, you know, as people, we're not totally pessimistic. We, and there's, you know, episodes in history or current day struggles where people have small victories or whatever. So we wanted to reflect that in the music, and the music changed and shifted, I think. And that was more who we were, I think, expressing some positivism amongst all the kind of doom and gloom that characterized some of our early songwriting and certainly some of the punk attitude.
I'm always fascinated, I guess as someone living in Canada, about the effects of the end of the miners' strike and then the election of Tony Blair and what that had on all facets of sort of like, I guess, the Red Wedge, but even underground music around that time in England, like how it just seemed to kind of fracture things a lot, like reflecting on it, like there was like a lot more divides begin to emerge. Like it seemed like people were a lot more united in the face of the miners' strike. And then certainly with the election of Tony Blair, there seems to be sort of like, I don't know, it just seems like things were kind of confused, or it was a cause of flux.
Yeah, I think so. So definitely, you know, the miners' strike for us represented a shift from anarcho-punk, which was kind of, you know, it was a very short-lived thing really at the time. And a lot of those bands have since reformed or whatever. And but a lot of those bands just lasted for a couple of years. And then the miners' strike happens, which, you know, and we all came from towns which historically had coal mines, and we perhaps had relatives who'd worked in mines. Harry, the drummer, is, you know, from Barnsley, and his dad was a singer, but he sang in miners' clubs, you know, but a lot of his relatives were miners, and it, you know, so it became a more, you know, and it was Thatcher as well. She was attacking various sections of the working class, you know, starting with the miners and dividing British society over it. And, you know, we played benefit shows and we became part of a miners support group and went to picket lines. And it was like, you know, working class people and trade unions in particular were under attack from the government and the cops. You know, if you went to a picket line, there's riot cops being riot cops. And I guess as we, you know, as the 80s progressed, I would say that, you know, at the end of Thatcher, when we had the poll tax, she, you know, the poll tax was an attack. Instead of picking on groups, it was an attack on the whole working class. You know, it was like the local tax an ordinary person pays is the same amount as a billionaire, which is basically what the poll tax was. And it was seen by a lot of people as just being totally unfair. And there was a, you know, a mass movement against it in Britain from people, you know, of all walks of working class kind of life. And, you know, there was a similar thing, I think, you know, with benefit shows around that, and bands who you may not normally play with who were on the same bill because we have this common interest. But I think after that, you know, once Thatcher was out of the picture and the 90s, which is seen as more, you know, Bill Clinton gets elected here, and I guess it was more, you know, culturally, okay, there's theoretically more money around and people aren't, you know, struggling as much. And Tony Blair was totally of that, you know, neoliberal kind of mindset. But I guess because we paid attention, it just seemed really obvious that all the promise, you know, and he got elected on this huge wave of optimism and hope, kind of like Obama. But we were just, I don't think cynical is the word. I think we were just, you know, paying attention that this is not, you know, this is not what it promises to be. You know, it's not going to suddenly, you know, and basically he turned the Labour Party, you know, the party that had formed from workers, you know, historically, and trade unions, and just turned it into this shell, which they are today. And it's going on today. There's an election, you know, next month, and Keir Starmer is, you know, Blair 2.0. And the, you know, the base, you know, a lot of ordinary Labour voters, are, you know, he's sacking people because they've expressed some pro-Palestine sentiment. You know, he's trying to weed that. He's very pro-Israel. And it just seems like the same old thing repeating again, Matt.
There's almost like a need for optimism that people have coming out of these eras. Like, you certainly see it where it shifts in the music too. Like the music goes from being Disorder to Megacity 4. And I love both those bands. So like, I've got room in my heart for both, but there's like you're saying, like there's this need for optimism. And I guess as cynical as you guys are the whole way through, Tub Thumping, I guess, plays into that need for, you know, people were just happy. Like everything was like, fuck it.
Oh yeah, maybe. I never thought of it like that. You know, so when Blair, you know, and particularly, you know, we threw water over deputy prime minister.
Did that fuck you as a musician in any way with border crossings? Like, did you get an assault charge? Because like,
No. So, you know, that you were talking about the division, and that really instantly, you know, like people like Billy Bragg and Manic Street Preachers were like, you fucking dimwits, why did you do that? You're shitting on the, you know, the working class guy in the Labour government. And so he did, you know, we were kind of more in that scene at that time where some of the major bands, I guess, or people more well-known were like, you know, publicly making comments, dismissing us or criticising us or not getting why we did it. And we did, it never really stopped us from doing anything. You know, we, straight after that, we went to Japan and then to the US. And we were in the US and we were about to go back to England. And it was just some wild rumor. You know, the manager came and said, oh, look, Dan, but I've just heard these rumors that if you go back to England, they're going to take your passport off you. I don't know where it came from. Anyway, so they convinced me, and we had another US tour starting like a week and a half later. So they convinced me to stay in America just so I didn't go back and lose the passport and then couldn't do the tour. And it was all fine. I had fun. But I think it was just rumor. You know, John Prescott, the guy, he chose not to press charges. Because it would have been more embarrassing for him, you know, to go through a court case. So it just kind of faded from the, You know, I mean, at the time, you know, I got arrested and handcuffed, and they're like, "Yeah, we're going to throw the book at you." And then the head of security at the Brit Awards, who I guess is like the equivalent of an FBI, you know,
MI5 kind of type guy.
Yeah. He's like, "Okay, you know, we know you are." And then he went off and he actually talked to John Prescott, and John Prescott must have said, "I don't want to press charges," because they had to let me go, you know.
I wonder if you, like, I'm sure there are Freedom of Information Act requests that you can do in England, but I wonder what file exists on Chumbawamba from the animal rights stuff, you know, this era. Like, I wonder what kind of, how thick that little document is.
I know, that's a really good question. I never really thought of it in those terms. You know, because we were involved in, as well as being a band, we were, like I said, we were involved in strike support groups, and a few of us went to Northern Ireland. There was a movement called Troops Out, and we had a friend who worked for them, and they did these trips to Belfast, you know, kind of like a political education trip, and we'd go to the ferry, and basically everyone on the trip got interviewed by MI5 probably before you got on the boat. So they're like, and it was just their way of saying, "Look, we know who you are, we know where you're going, we know what you're doing." You know, in the days before they could track you with your phone or whatever.
Well,
so there's definitely something. Yeah,
it's wild when you read, I think it's in the book GB84, which I know is a fictional book, but like reading about stuff afterwards, the amount of technology they were using to spy on people at that time and the amount of information they were gathering on quote unquote subversive left wing organizations like unions. So I can only imagine what they were doing to punk kids at that point.
Yeah.
So I brought up that the ALF is watching compilation that you guys are on with, which also features the band Statement and the band Vegan Reich. And
I didn't know that. I should look up, I probably have a copy of that somewhere.
Vegan Reich's an interesting band because they're definitely not a Nazi band, but they are certainly an extreme political band. And
yeah,
that's part of the hardline movement, which definitely had a big thing in Memphis where that incident took place with you guys. And that's something that evolved out of anarcho politics in America.
Yeah.
You know, like you're saying, it's such a short period of time that that anarcho punk is happening in the UK, but how that spreads globally and the global reach of that, not just aesthetically, but politically and sonically, is so immense. Like
And I guess, you know, before instant social media spread, it's more organic and slow, but as you say, an amazing reach.
That ALF comp is watching is fantastic. Like the mix of bands on it is wild. Like, as I said, the bands I mentioned before, but it's also got Beefeater and like Oi Polloi and Powerage from South Africa.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, as it spreads, it's particular, like you said, the hard, it mutates as well, I think. So you get good things out of those mutations and things that maybe aren't as close to the original. And I think, you know, we always find it, you know, if you're in any kind of protest group, you know, from Hunt Saboteurs to strike support groups, particularly with the animal rights, I don't know why it was, but there were people whose personality was just, I won't say fascist, but authoritarian, you know, that it's like a very purist thing. And I think it happens in all walks of life. There are just some people who, you know, they gravitate to punk or whatever it is, but their personal operating system, if you like, is quite rigid, which in many ways contradicts what I think punk is about. But
it's interesting with the animal rights thing, because I think for some people there's real stakes attached to it, and that's not to undercut their beliefs, but out of anything attached to punk, that might be the most sort of punk born extremist
yeah Yeah. I think you're right.
Like there's, it just, when did you guys first become kind of aware of vegetarianism and also, I guess, veganism? Like,
I mean, you know, as a kid, you knew of it, but it just seemed like some wacky thing because, you know, British culture, like American culture, you know, meat is like a big deal. And I think for us, we just started seeing Crash shows, and you know, and Crash, when they did a show, it was a whole event. It was mind blowing. So they'd have films and leaflets, and you could go talk to them after the show, before the show. It was just a completely different approach. But one of these films, some of their films, you know, were like from a slaughterhouse or whatever, and they're projecting this, and there's music going on. And I think the clips were, there was this film called The Animal, was it called The Animals Film? I think it was. And it was like a 1980s documentary, and a lot of it was, you know, what happens in a slaughterhouse. And they had leaflets about it, and that kind of, you know, it just became, oh yeah, this is like a form of oppression that we've not been aware of. Or, and it, you know, a group of peers or whatever took in ideas, and then you influence one on each other. And it was kind of after that, so it was like a political thing in the beginning. And then there's, you know, the ALF, and we went on some ALF kind of protests, and as I said, hunt saboteurs. And it seemed, you know, unlike most areas of protest, there was occasionally, you could see immediate gains, like, you know, going to a factory farm and invading it and coming out with animals to save them, kind of thing. So it was like, or hunt saboteur, you could literally save a fox from being butchered, you know. Not all the time, sometimes it didn't work, but so there was an appeal in that way. And the 1980s in Britain, it was just, yeah, it was like the big ALF guy, Ronnie Lee. We lived in Leeds, and the prison was like a mile and a half from where we lived. And the ALF people, the guys, would go in the local prison, and they'd be on remand, and they'd be locked up for 23 hours a day. But they had a half an hour a day where you could visit. So we became part of a prisoner support group, and we could go in and take them vegan food or whatever initially, and then they stopped that. But you could, you know, have conversations with the guy who was the main writer of the ALF newsletter, kind of thing.
It's wild when, I guess, VCR is the technology that spreads it, but when I started going to punk shows and all of a sudden someone hands you a videotape and it's some wild slaughterhouse hidden camera footage or the ALF documentary, like it felt like that was such a part of 90s, certainly hardcore culture or punk culture. And it's weird because it's almost like there's been a depoliticization of veganism too, in a way. Like you don't really, it's much more lifestyle based now than it's political based.
I mean, I'm not a vegan, but I was for a time. But yeah, you know, you can go in restaurants and they'll have a vegan option. And you know, in the 80s, there was nothing.
No,
like,
it was like a chore. It was like a burden you had to cr a cross you had to bear.
So I mean, you know, it's good. It's good. But of course, capitalism's kind of, you know, taken over a lot of veganism, you know, I guess, and as it does with anything it can get its hands on.
Yeah, like there was, it feels like that's, I guess, the goal of capitalism is to kind of consume anything that stands in opposition to it and strip it of that power. And you see that in music, right? Like there's a real push to take that message away from bands. And
yeah, and I mean, you know, the whole EMI Universal thing, we were seen in that context, and I totally get it. I totally get it why people would think, oh, this band who were on a fuck EMI compilation are now signed to EMI. And you know, our experience of it, like I said, we signed up and thought it'd last a year, but it did give us these platforms that we would never have had. And I don't, to this day, I don't know if you could say we were successful in subverting things a little bit, or we just got sucked into it. I mean, we did come out the other side and continued to make interesting and political albums, and I think that route we took is, I won't say unique, but it's very unusual for a band to navigate that and come out the other side.
There's definitely been bands that have used politics as a marketing thing, but in terms of like truly political bands, I'd say you guys and in America, Rage Against the Machine. And I don't know if about international music to know the international things, but
yeah,
the two bands that did it and tried to retain the core value of what it was in the band. But unlike Chumbawamba, Rage Against the Machine didn't have this whole history prior to kind of contend with, where you guys have, like it's just such so many interesting eras of the band, right? Like you were talking about, there's that European period with the X as one period. There's that pre-anarcho period. Then there's obviously the massive like single period, and then there's all the stuff afterwards, and then obviously your solo stuff after. And like there's like it's a really interesting band to kind of study in terms of punk history. Were you a fan of the Donkees, Neil Ferguson's band?
So they were part of the, maybe we'd call them the second wave, you know, the initial wave of punk in England inspired all these people in like the smaller towns or whatever. And the Donkees had a, you know, which was kind of similar to the Not Sensibles. They had a minor hit, really, you know, where you'd sell, I don't know, 20,000 records or whatever. So I can't remember the song, but we knew the song and we're like, oh yeah, this is a really cool, you know, because there was an element of English punk bands. They not comedy, but they were just eccentric and a bit zany and just
kind of
uplifted.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut off. Sorry.
Yeah. I'm thinking of other bands, The Shapes, who came and played, you know, and they just have maybe like an EP or an album at the most. And then they, and anyway, as a result of that, Neil, and his bandmates got a chunk of money. I don't know how much it was, but he bought a studio from that and he became a studio engineer. And we did like 98% of Chumbawamba records were done in his studio. And then he eventually became part of the band, you know.
Yeah, the Donkees had a couple records, but Not Sensibles, I just think, had that one single, but it must have sold like a ton because there's a couple pressings of it, I know, at least.
They did have an album and a couple of other 7-inches, but yeah, that one song for those guys is kind of what they're remembered for.
Yeah, like there's just so many records that come out in that wave of stuff. It's kind of like 1977 to like 1982 that are just like incredible.
Yeah,
it's, I also am really interested because like early on, like you mentioned, doing the stuff with Bjork. I wonder if Bjork ever had to take heat when she signed to the major label from the anarchist scene in Iceland. I wonder if people were pissed at her.
Yeah. You know, we see, you know, when I go back to the UK, we often go through Iceland and you can get off and have a few days there and then get back on the plane in the same price of a ticket. So one time I did it with my children, and just, you know, just hanging out in Reykjavik, you get the sense that Björk is a national treasure kind of thing. Because I guess, you know, Iceland's population's like less than 500,000.
You guys also had a connection to a State of Mind. Yeah, that split with them.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
And we're on Mind Over Matter Records. But did you guys didn't get over to America till later on, though, right?
No, the first time was 1990, yeah. So that was all done through, you know, like I said, we made a contact with a lot of the bands on the Crass compilation by just writing letters, and it's the same thing. I don't know who initiated it, whether it was Robbie or State of Mind or one of us, but we were in this, you know, exchange through snail mail, and we said, oh, let's do an EP together. And yeah. And then years, when we did come to America, we did meet those guys, which was kind of nice.
It's an interesting period in America then too, because it's just before Nirvana happens, and
oh yeah, yeah.
And then Green Day, of course, is right around the corner as well. And there's sort of this
yeah
giant flux that kind of happens in American underground music then too.
Oh yeah, that like Nirvana in particular, you know, because I live, you know, well, I live 4 hours from Seattle, but it's the nearest big city. So I go there. I wasn't really aware of all the other bands like Pearl Jam. In Britain, it seemed to be Nirvana, but they did, you know, for British bands and even bands now, you know, a lot of some teenage bands, they still want to sound like Nirvana, you know, guitar, that sound of Nevermind.
Yeah, you walk through the mall near my house now, and every store is selling some sort of Nirvana repro shirt, like at the mall stores. Every kid's got a Nirvana shirt on.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, I don't know. Not, maybe you're not, but I'm always wondering, I don't know if this is what Kurt Cobain would have wanted.
No, I think you're right. Yeah.
It's like that. Maybe it's not, don't always get what you wish for, because it might not be exactly what you hoped it would be.
Yeah.
And especially with that sort of thing, like you lose, I don't know, you don't lose, but once you give something out to the world, it's no longer in your control. You no longer can say who interprets it as what.
Yeah, and we definitely feel that with the song. We call it the song, the big song or whatever. You know, we get royalty statements, and still, you know, and we have, I don't know, X hundred songs. You know, we had 11 studio albums. I have like 5 or 6. But 99% of the royalties are from that one song, you know.
And I think that song stands, and I don't mean to like now pontificate on you. I'm sorry if I'm a man, but like I feel like that song stands as an obstacle in this incredible catalog before and after that you guys have for a lot of people. Because like for me, I wasn't like an old, super old school fan or anything, but like I got into you guys on the Noam Chomsky split. And
oh yeah, yeah,
and that blew my mind as a kid. Like I just couldn't believe it. And then going back and hearing all the other records, and then this song happens. It's almost like two different bands. Like from looking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, to us from the inside, it didn't seem like that. We wrote that song, and we thought this would just be a really good live song. And we had other songs like that. So it was mystifying to us as well. In the beginning, and then like to come back to your original point, it just takes on a life of its own. You can't control it. And you know, it just happened recently in New Zealand, and it's happened a handful of times where right-wing politicians have used it without our permission. As they come on stage, they play that song or whatever, and some guy in New Zealand just did it, and you know, and we tell the record company or the publishing company and the management, and they write a cease and desist letter and send it. And then after that, it's like, do you go to court, which is going to cost thousands of dollars, pounds. But usually the cease and desist works. But there was an Australian guy who was like, the Australian Trump a few years ago, they called him, who insisted on using it. So it was just, but we couldn't afford to, you know, get involved in a six-figure court situation.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like, oi, the mainstream real world, where it's kind of immune to subversion, because they'll just assume whatever,
yeah,
and just strip it of its meaning and use it as they want to.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, there's that side of it. And then there's a side of it, people who, you know, some college kid doing a student project who wants to put it on the film, or, you know, striking workers used it as a metaphor for their struggle. And so it's the whole spectrum, and that's it. You just can't control which part of the spectrum wants to use it, because there's people across the board who see something in it, I guess.
Well, and also, like, how many people use that song to wake up and motivate them to get them out the door every morning? And I'm countless. Like, you know, it's just one of those things that's become just a part of, like, you know, culture, people's lives. So I could punish you forever, Danvert, and I don't want to keep you all day, because you probably have stuff to do. But I got to say, anytime you want to come back on this podcast, you are always welcome.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, it's fascinating having this conversation. I mean, I can go a little bit longer if you...
Did you ever meet Noam Chomsky?
No, no. So it's AK Press, isn't it, that did that one? Yeah, we knew the guy who set up AK, and I think it was his idea to do it, and we're just saying, yeah, that sounds great. And it's funny you mention it. A lot of people seem to have that same experience, that they that's where they first heard us, or first realized that we were more than the big song, you know, retrospectively, because that came out before. But yeah,
I think it had really good distribution in North America compared to your other records. AK Press it was in my local store, in a way that I had to search for the earlier records after that.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah,
when I saw Noam Chomsky in Toronto do a lecture, someone asked him about the split.
Oh, okay.
And he said, he's like, well, I actually, to be honest with you, don't listen to any rock music whatsoever. I'm lucky that my kids only liked folk music, because I didn't even really like the Beatles.
Yeah.
It's a great record, though, and it definitely served me. It also exposed me to Patrick Fitzgerald for the first time, too.
Oh, yeah. So Patrick Fitzgerald, you know, he had a couple of EPs, and he was, for me personally, but for Chumbawamba as well, he stood out from the punk scene, because he was just, you know, him and an acoustic guitar, and he'd play shows. And we saw him at they had a big anti-Nazi carnival in London, and the Clash were headlining, and he was on early in the afternoon, and, you know, the mosh pit or whatever were like throwing beer cans at him, you know, because they didn't think he were punk, but to me, and you know, I guess I was inspired by his first, you know, Safety Pin Stuck in My Heart, to start writing songs on acoustic guitar. And to this day, most of the shows I play are like that.
It's crazy you bring that show up, because that show, Billy Bragg brings up as being the reason he decided to play electric, because he got bottled at that show, and he was like, I got to be electric if I ever do that.
Yeah.
Also, didn't Tom Robinson Band play that show as well?
I think so. Yeah, there were two, and I think they did play that one. There was a later one. It was like Elvis Costello and Steel Pulse, I think. But yeah, I think Tom Robinson was on that an original one. Yeah,
that's another group that I've always, you know, had a similarity to Chumbawamba to me, in the sense that it wasn't straight aggro.
Yeah, yeah,
and that's the best thing about this thing, is that it can be whatever, right? Like, it doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
One thing or the other thing.
Yeah.
Well, Danvert, anytime you want to come back on this, you know you are always welcome.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I totally appreciate it, Damien. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.